Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, John Russell, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
American George Ball thinks he has one of the best-paying jobs available in the Chesapeake Bay area. The Chesapeake Bay stretches over 300 kilometers from Maryland to southeastern Virginia before its waters finally reach the Atlantic Ocean. George Bell catches a fish called the Atlantic menhaden. Ball says that in the area where he lives, there are not too many good jobs like his. His ancestors also were fishermen, so he does not want to change jobs. Starting over would be treacherous, he told the Associated Press. Ball works for a business called Omega Protein. It processes his menhaden catch to make fish oil pills and feed for farm-raised salmon. But the company is facing increasing restrictions on fishing. Critics say it could be harming the Chesapeake Bay by overfishing. Last year, Omega Protein caught 30% more fish than legal catch limits in the Chesapeake. As a result, the federal government is threatening to place a temporary ban on menhaden fishing in Virginia's waters. The Marine Stewardship Council, a not-for-profit environmental group, is reconsidering the company's certification for sustainability. Environmental groups, sport fishermen, and some state lawmakers are calling for restrictions on the company's fishing operations. The harvest limit that Omega Protein did not obey was put in place to protect the Chesapeake Bay area. The bay is America's largest estuary, a place where fresh water and seawater mix. Many animals, including striped bass and humpback whales, depend on the Atlantic menhaden for food. The Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission sets rules for fishing. The group set the fishing limits as a precautionary measure while it learns more about the menhaden population. Omega Protein has promised to obey the catch limits in the future. But it also says there is no scientific evidence that the fish are being over-harvested or that the area is being harmed. Omega Protein is important to the local economy. A 2017 study found that the business added $88 million to the state's economy. It also said that the company's closure would cut the local county's earnings by 14% and employment by 8%. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
When the Islamic State, IS, group moved across northern Iraq in 2014, its forces tried to destroy the Yazidi people. Yazidis are an ethnic minority in Iraq. They had lived in the mountains of Kurdistan for 1,000 years. IS fighters killed thousands of Yazidis and enslaved many women and girls. The Yazidi culture was threatened with genocide. Now, the British-based Amar Foundation is leading a project that aims to teach young Yazidis the ancient music of their ancestors. The aid group also hopes to create a permanent record of their culture. The British government is providing financial support to the project. Yazidi music is thought to be between 5,000 and 7,000 years old. However, it has never been written down or recorded. Traditional Yazidi musicians hand down the music from one generation to the next. Musicians memorize up to 500 individual pieces of music. There are three kinds of music: traditional folk music, which is linked to agriculture, ceremonial music, and religious music. Now, these sounds are being heard far beyond the homeland in northern Iraq. British violinist Michael Bachmann is leading the Amar program. This month, he invited the musicians to perform at the Trinity Laban Conservatoire of Music and Dance in London. The music of the Yazidi people is essential to their culture, he told VOA. Only a small group of people, the Qawls caste, are permitted to sing the music. There are only 16 of them left, Bachmann added. He said he knew it was important to record the music for future generations. Amar has made over 100 recordings in northern Iraq. Some were produced at Lalish, the 4,000-year-old spiritual home of the Yazidi. Sound engineers and musicians are also visiting refugee camps, where tens of thousands of Yazidi people still live after the IS campaign. Hundreds of young Yazidis are learning to play the instruments of their culture. They include a stringed instrument known as a tabor and a kind of drum known as the daf. Among the Yazidis visiting London were several women who had been held captive by Islamic State. Among them was Ranas, who was only 14 when IS forces captured her village. She says she faced abuse every day. Ranas was later released after her family paid money. She was forced to leave behind the daughter she gave birth to while held captive. Ranas says the music project helps her forget the past. "I want this support to continue. Thanks to this project, our people did not lose hope. And if they will continue to help us, we will not give up," she told VOA. I'm Susan Shand.
In the American film Pulp Fiction, actor Samuel L. Jackson challenges two criminals. They are trying to take money from all of the people in a restaurant. Jackson plays the part of a former criminal who used to carry out targeted killings. He wants to change his life and does not want to hurt people anymore. But he does not want to give his money to criminals either. Jackson asks one of the criminals to use an adjective. He asks her to describe Fonzie, a character from the old American television show Happy Days.
Nobody's gonna hurt anybody. We're all gonna be like three little Fonzies here. And what's Fonzie like? Come on, Yolanda, what's Fonzie like?
Cool.
What?
Cool.
Correctamundo. And that's what we're gonna be. We're gonna be cool.
Today, we will explore the term that Jackson wanted to hear. Cool, a word that has both formal and casual uses. The casual, everyday uses of cool will be our topic of discussion. But first, we begin with a little history.
Cool has its roots in the Old English term cool, meaning not warm, notes the Online Etymology Dictionary. Google Ngram has evidence of cool being used as far back as the 16th century. In other words, cool has a long history. The writer William Shakespeare even used the term in many of his plays, including Othello and Much Ado About Nothing. But cool's meanings have changed over time. By the 20th century, among its other meanings, cool eventually came to suggest a kind of effortlessness. Fonzie, the character you heard about at the beginning of this report, gives you one example of the idea. He does humorous, wonderful things without seeming to try very hard. Yet Fonzie did not invent cool. Some people claim this effortless, stylish way of acting is a product of African-American art. Joel Dienerstein wrote a book called The Origins of Cool in Postwar America. He says cool came from an artistic movement led primarily by black musicians. Lester Young, a saxophone player, is said to have made the term popular in jazz music circles in the 1930s and 1940s. To be cool, Dienerstein noted, meant you carried personal authority through a stylish mask of stoicism. In other words, cool meant you endured hardship, but did not express it outwardly.
Over time, cool lost its connection with artistic movements and became more common in everyday speech. It still carries many meanings as a verb, noun, adjective, and adverb. However, in casual situations, Americans often use cool as an adjective or as an adverb. As an adjective, cool generally has three meanings. It can describe something as appealing in a way that people like, especially young people. For example, Americans often say things like cool sunglasses or cool clothes. Cool can show approval in a very general way. Imagine you introduce one of your friends to your father. After the meeting, your friend might say,
"Your dad is so cool."
Cool can also show acceptance, agreement, or understanding. Consider this situation. You are running late to a meeting with a friend. You send a text message to apologize for your delay. Your friend might respond with the following message.
"That's cool. No worries."
The Amazon television show Patriot used cool in this way. The main character, a spy named John Lakeman, often gets terrible news. He shows acceptance by saying, "Cool."
Cool. That's cool.
As an adverb, cool generally means in a calm manner. Two of the most common uses might be in the terms act cool and play it cool. Imagine two children were playing around and accidentally broke something. Perhaps they broke a lamp or a dish in the house. Then they hear one of their parents opening the door of their house. One child might say to the other,
"When Dad walks in, just act cool. Don't say anything."
Or,
"When Mom comes in, we have to play it cool, or she will start to suspect something."
Finally, a word of warning. Americans generally describe other people with the adjective cool. They do not use it to describe themselves. This is where culture and grammar meet. An American would consider a statement such as, "I am cool," to be strange, even if it is grammatically correct. So, when speaking with friends, feel free to use the term cool. Although informal, it has a good, positive meaning. But you should think of cool as a gift you can give to others. If you give that gift to yourself, well, that's just not cool. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Vice President Calvin Coolidge became president in 1923, following the death of President Warren Harding. Coolidge quickly gained the trust of most Americans by investigating the crimes of Harding's top officials. The conservative economic policies of the new president also won wide support. Coolidge had 1 year to prove his abilities to the American people before the election of 1924. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about that election.
Coolidge was a quiet man who believed in limited government policies, but his silence hid a fighting political spirit. Coolidge had worked for many years to gain the White House. He would not give it up without a struggle. Coolidge moved quickly after becoming president to gain control of the Republican Party. He named his own advisors to important jobs, and he replaced a number of officials with people whose loyalty he could trust. Most Republicans liked Coolidge. They felt his popular policies would make him a strong candidate in the presidential election. For this reason, Coolidge faced only one serious opponent for the Republican presidential nomination in 1924. Coolidge's opponent was the great automobile manufacturer Henry Ford of Michigan. Ford had been a Democratic candidate for the Senate in 1918. He lost that election. But after the election, some people in his company began to call for Ford to be the Republican presidential nominee in 1924.
Ford was one of history's greatest inventors and manufacturers. But he had limited skills in politics. Ford was poorly educated. He had extreme opinions about a number of groups. He hated labor unions, the stock market, dancing, smoking, and drinking alcohol. But most of all, Ford hated Jews. He produced a number of publications accusing the Jewish people of organizing international plots. At first, Ford appeared to be a strong opponent to Coolidge. But soon he realized that Coolidge was too strong politically. His economic policies were popular among the people, and the nation was at peace. The party could not deny Coolidge's nomination. Ford himself put an end to his chances by telling the nation that it was perfectly safe with Coolidge. Calvin Coolidge won the presidential nomination easily at the 1924 Republican Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. The Republican delegates chose Charles Dawes of Illinois to run with him as the vice presidential candidate.
The Democratic Party was much more divided. Many of the groups that traditionally supported Democratic candidates now were fighting against each other. For example, many farmers did not agree on policies with people living in cities. The educated did not agree with uneducated people. And many Protestant workers felt divided from Roman Catholic and Jewish workers. These differences made it hard for the Democratic Party to choose a national candidate. There was little spirit of compromise. Two main candidates campaigned for the Democratic nomination. The first was former Treasury Secretary William McAdoo. McAdoo had the support of many Democrats because of his strong administration of the railroads during the World War. Democratic voters in southern and western states liked him because of his conservative racial policies and his opposition to alcohol. The second main candidate was Alfred Smith, the governor of New York. Smith was a Roman Catholic. He was very popular with people in the eastern cities, Roman Catholics, and supporters of legal alcohol. But many rural delegates to the convention did not trust him.
The Democratic Party convention met in New York City. It quickly became a battle between the more liberal delegates from the cities and the more conservative delegates from rural areas. It was July. The heat was intense. Speaker after speaker appealed to the delegates for votes. One day passed, then another. For 9 days, the nation listened on the radio as the delegates argued about the nomination. The delegates voted 95 times without success. Finally, McAdoo and Smith agreed to withdraw from the race. Even then, the delegates had to vote 8 more times before they finally agreed on compromise candidates. The Democratic delegates finally chose John Davis to be their presidential nominee. Davis was a lawyer for a major bank. He had served briefly under President Wilson as ambassador to Britain. The delegates also chose Charles Bryan to be the vice presidential candidate. Bryan was the younger brother of the famous Democrat and populist leader William Jennings Bryan.
There also was a third party in the 1924 election. Many of the old progressive supporters of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson opposed the choices of the Republicans and Democrats. They thought the country needed another candidate to keep alive the spirit of reform. Progressive candidates had done well in the congressional election of 1922. But following the election, communists had gained influence in one of the major progressive parties. Most progressives did not want to join with communists, so they formed a new progressive party. The new party named Senator Robert La Follette, of Wisconsin to be its presidential candidate. La Follette campaigned for increased taxes on the rich and public ownership of water power. He called for an end to child labor and limits on the power of the courts to interfere in labor disputes. And La Follette warned the nation about the dangers of single, large companies gaining control of important industries.
Coolidge won the 1924 election easily. He won the electoral votes of 35 states to just 12 for Davis of the Democrats. La Follette won only Wisconsin, his home state. Coolidge also won more popular votes than the other two candidates together. The American people voted for Coolidge partly to thank him for bringing back honesty and trust to the White House following the crimes of the Harding administration. But the main reason was that they liked his conservative economic policies and his support of business.
La Follette's Progressive Party died following the 1924 election. Most of his supporters later joined the Democrats, but the reform spirit of their movement remained alive through the next 4 years. They were difficult years for progressives. Conservatives in Congress passed laws reducing taxes for corporations and richer Americans.
Progressives fought for reforms in national agriculture policies. Most farmers did not share in the general economic growth of the 1920s. Instead, their costs increased while the price of their products fell. Many farmers lost their farms. Farmers and progressives wanted the federal government to create a system to control prices and the total supply of food produced. They said the government should buy and keep any extra food that farmers produced, and they called for officials to help them export food. Coolidge and most Republicans rejected these ideas. They said it was not the business of a free government to fix farm prices, and they feared the high costs of creating a major new government department and developing export markets. Coolidge vetoed three major farm reform bills following his election.
The debate over farm policy was in many ways like the debate over taxes or public controls on power companies. There was a basic difference of opinion about the proper actions of government. More conservative Americans believed the purpose of government was to support private business, not to control it. But more liberal Americans believed that government needed to do more to make sure that citizens of all kinds could share the nation's wealth more equally. Coolidge and the Republicans were in control in the 1920s. For this reason, the nation generally stayed on a conservative path. The Democrats and progressives would have to wait until later to put many of their more liberal ideas into action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.